sponsored in part by Eli Lilly and Company. Do you think you might have migraine? Talk to your healthcare professional about your symptoms, the number of days they impact your life, and which treatment options might be best for you. Learn more at thinkmigraine.com. And the American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatment, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. The Epilepsy Foundation leads the fight to overcome the challenges of living with epilepsy and to accelerate therapies, stop seizures, find cures, and save lives. Visit epilepsy.com to find out how to get involved today. And by Neurelis, a leading neuroscience company focused on the development and commercialization of therapeutics for the treatment of epilepsy and other neurologic disorders. The company's unique drug portfolio strives to address unmet needs in patient care. Learn more at Neurelis.com.
Hi. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, a neurologist who practices at the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida. This is What's Health Got to Do with It, which looks at where and how healthcare intersects with your life, helping you get the medical answers you want. Coming up, come fly with us as we talk about in-flight healthcare. But first, do you remember your first flight? I do. I was only 12 years old when I was to accompany my grandmother on a flight from Shreveport, Louisiana to Miami, Florida, connecting in Atlanta because she didn't speak English. I was so excited that I even dressed up in a suit for the experience. Well, that first flight hit turbulence due to thunderstorms in the southeast, leading to my throwing up constantly from motion sickness. It was horrible. My grandmother was muttering Spanish phrases under her breath, which would be inappropriate for me to translate at this time. The flight attendant helped me by giving me a cold towel and ginger ale. It worked. And as such, this was my first encounter with in-flight health. Fast forward to a few decades later, when I'm a doctor and my wife and I are on a flight from Phoenix to Minneapolis. I was sleeping, but was awakened by an announcement asking if there was a doctor on the flight. I responded and proceeded to see a passenger in flight who had passed out from a seizure. I did my consultation, and both a flight attendant and the captain came back to see if we needed to land urgently. Thankfully, we didn't because the passenger awoke and was okay. We landed early in Minneapolis, and on disembarking, the flight attendants thanked me and handed me a sealed envelope for my help. It was a $2 drink coupon for any bar of my choosing at the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport. So today, we focus on in-flight health and how to prevent and manage in-flight health emergencies so that no one has to hear the announcement, "Is there a doctor on this flight?" Joining us are two terrific co-pilots, can I say, actually physicians, that are going to be providing information for us. We have Dr. William Brady. He is an emergency physician at the University of Virginia Health System and a professor of emergency medicine at the University of Virginia Medical School. Dr. Brady, welcome.
Thank you.
And we have Dr. Nabel. He is an emergency physician at the MedStar Georgetown University Hospital, and he is also an associate professor of emergency medicine at the Georgetown University School of Medicine. And both of them have written an academic textbook on this topic. Dr. Nabel, welcome.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
It's so great to have you both. So we're going to get started. And Dr. Brady, I'm going to start with you. How common are in-flight medical emergencies?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And we don't have an exact answer because there's no requirement for reporting these events. What we do know based on different entities that follow flight emergencies, in the United States, it's roughly about 10 events per day. That's based on a typical number of flights in any 24-hour period. And looking at the data that we have, we can estimate and in some cases guesstimate, it's about 10 events per 24 hours. When we look at the global picture around the entire world, that number greatly increases, of course. And again, based on some extrapolated data, we're talking about 110 or so events in any 24-hour period.
So if I'm understanding you right, when you say these events, these are reported medical emergencies of or something that occurs on a flight. So on a global scale, there's about 110 flights or so that something's occurring. And in the U.S., there's about 10 flights or so a day.
That's correct, sir. Yep, exactly.
Okay. Dr. Nabel, when these in-flight medical emergencies occur, what are the most common medical conditions that are occurring?
That's a great question. And again, since there's no centralized reporting system for these, it can be a little bit challenging to exactly tease out, but we can glean some information based on some research that's been put out into the literature. One of them was a study that looked at a ground-based consultation service, right? So if you're an airline, you aren't necessarily going to have a doctor or a nurse or any other healthcare provider on every single flight. So you need to be able to call someone on the ground and say, hey, we've got this person having this. What do we do? Well, this study looked at records of one of those ground-based consultation services. And what they found in terms of the most common types of issues that airlines encounter up in the skies, the most common is passing out. So of the emergencies that are reported, about a third involve passing out. The next most common is breathing issues, so like difficulty breathing, followed pretty closely by nausea and vomiting, and then some sort of cardiac issues. But those are the most common issues. And I think the central message is that these are the types of events that are fairly common on the ground. These are things that we see all the time in emergency rooms across the country. And so these are things that aren't necessarily out of this world type of cases. These are mostly things that are readily handled on the ground by qualified medical personnel.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. Dr. Brady, are there easy preventative measures that passengers can take or do pre-flight to avoid having an in-flight medical emergency?
Oh, absolutely. I think probably the best approach is to, first of all, question yourself. If you are feeling unwell, if you are recently injured, if you're just not feeling appropriate from a health perspective, please don't get on an aircraft.
Right.
Because an aircraft is an aircraft. It's a commercial airliner. It is a way of traveling from point A to point B. And none of us, you know, myself, Dr. Nabel, you, anyone, we really shouldn't assume that we're going to receive correct specialty-driven medical care if we have some sort of mishap during air travel. So bottom line is, let's all use our common sense. And if we don't feel right, or a family member doesn't look right, it's probably not a good idea to get on a commercial airliner and get up at altitude away from comprehensive medical care. Next thing to think about is talking to your primary healthcare provider. You know, if you have a chronic illness, a medical condition of some sort, you've just had a procedure, and you're planning a travel sometime in the near future, talk to your primary healthcare provider and get guidance. When is it safe for me to fly after my surgery? What should I do about my medications? If I'm on oxygen at home, supplemental oxygen at home, what do I do about traveling in the air? And all of those different issues. And I guess the third point is too, wherever you're traveling to, let's make sure that where you're traveling to is an appropriate location that can provide some degree of medical care as well. So common sense and a very basic preventative approach, working with your primary healthcare provider, is the best way to prevent in-flight medical emergencies.
I want to underscore that. It sounds so easy, but boy, it sounds like it's still occurring a lot. But that's great advice. Dr. Nabel, we are talking about in-flight health and this issue of being in this plane. Planes are pressurized to mimic the way people feel as they're walking on the ground. How does that occur, and what effects does that have on the human body? Because I think that pertains to why sometimes these occur in the air.
That's a great question. So airlines do pressurize their cabins, and that's because We obviously can't breathe in air that is equivalent to the altitude that our commercial airliners fly at, right? They're flying at 30,000 feet, 40,000 feet. And that's obviously not an altitude that humans can breathe in that air. And so what commercial airliners do is they pressurize their cabins, but the way that they do it, and for a variety of different reasons, they can't pressurize them to sea level. In fact, most commercial airliners pressurize their cabins somewhere between 6 and 8,000 feet. So essentially what you're doing is, instead of breathing air that's equivalent to being at sea level, it's as if you're breathing air and you climbed some sort of elevation that is at 8,000 feet. And so at that level, there is a noticeable reduction in the amount of oxygen that's in the air. And for that reason, some passengers who may have underlying heart or lung issues may be a little bit more susceptible to developing acute medical events in flight. And the other thing is, because of how airlines pressurize their cabins, they often can lead to dehumidification, a very dry environment in the cabins, which means that passengers can become dehydrated while they're up at altitude.
That makes perfect sense. And thanks for that nice explanation. Dr. Brady, there's an in-flight medical emergency. They put out a call for help on that plane. Who exactly is in charge of the situation, of the ultimate decisions that occur at that time?
In that situation, the pilot in command is in charge of the situation, not the doctor, not the nurse, not the paramedic, not the healthcare provider that has volunteered to step up and help out. Because the pilot in command of the aircraft has to think about the safety of the person that's having the emergency, about the volunteer healthcare provider, and every other human being on that aircraft. Okay. So that is a large responsibility, obviously. So the pilot has to factor in safety issues for everyone on the aircraft. And in some cases, people that are situated below the flight path of the aircraft, where the aircraft could land, might land, maybe will land. So the pilot has to consider the big picture. What's the weather down below? How much fuel is on board? What's the traffic burden? How quickly can we land, et cetera, et cetera? So there's a lot the pilot has to factor in above and beyond the health and safety of that one person experiencing a medical problem. The volunteer healthcare provider, of course, is involved, but that person must realize that he or she is making recommendations to the flight crew, the flight attendants, and the pilot in command, or the co-pilot, if that's who you're speaking with. So that's a very important distinction for healthcare providers to understand, as well as passengers to understand.
So the pilot is in charge, the captain of the plane.
Yep. The pilot is the captain, and he or she will make decisions that are appropriate for everyone on board, optimizing safety, optimizing less inconvenience, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, while I don't speak for any of the airlines, nor do I truly understand the internal workings, I know that in the couple events I've been involved in, the pilot is clearly factored in the safety of the person having the emergency, but also factored in the safety of every other human being on board that aircraft.
And Dr. Brady, one follow-up question. When I get on a plane, what I notice is that the flight attendant locks the pilots up in the front. I'm in the back, and the person is sick out there. How do the pilots, how do they know that there's a situation? How do they get involved?
Well, I would assume that the flight attendants will notify the pilot that something out of the ordinary is occurring on the aircraft, number one, as a routine matter. Number two, as the healthcare provider, you can ask to speak to the pilot. Of course, you're not going to do it face-to-face unless the pilot comes out of the cockpit.
Right.
The couple times I've done that has been via radio telephone, where I actually speak to the captain of the aircraft. I assess the patient and do what I think is appropriate. And in the couple situations where I felt that we truly had an emergency, I actually asked to speak to the pilot, and in both cases was connected almost immediately, and then had a brief conversation describing in non-medical terminology what was going on. And it was very clear the captain was asking questions in a formatted way that helped him arrive at a decision. In addition to speaking to the volunteer healthcare provider, the captain in some cases has access to the services that Dr. Nabel mentioned a couple questions ago, where the pilot or flight attendant can reach out to ground-based medical services that the airlines work with. They're usually staffed with emergency physicians that are aware of the, you know, quite frankly, austere medical environment of an aircraft, understand the physics of flight, meaning, you know, the pressurizations, et cetera, and that can serve as a good guide for the pilot in command too, to get a check on what he or she's been told by the volunteer medical provider, or if there's a situation where no one is able to volunteer, the captain of the aircraft may describe the situation to the ground-based provider, who then will give them directions about what to do from the big picture perspective.
Appreciate that. And to our listeners, you're listening to What's Health Got to Do with It on WJCT News 89.9. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and if you're just joining us, we're talking about in-flight medical care, and we want to hear from you. If you have an idea for future shows, tweet me at jservin. Dr. Nabel, let's say that an emergency like a stroke or heart attack are occurring. I take it from what Dr. Brady said that the pilot's going to decide on landing emergently. Is that how that works? If you have like an active emergency like that, is that how it works?
That's a great question. Yes, that is ultimately how it works. The captain needs to factor in a lot of decision or a lot of factors into making that decision. If there happens to be a volunteer healthcare provider on board the aircraft, they might lend their insight into that decision-making process. If there isn't, the captain is likely going to be consulting with their ground-based consultation service and say, hey, this is what we have on board. We're having this person with these symptoms. Do we need to land? After all, there really aren't many diagnostic equipment aboard these aircraft, right? So you're not necessarily going to know that somebody's having a stroke, but they're going to have some symptoms that might resemble a stroke. And so that captain is going to then talk to their ground-based consultation service and say, this is what we have. What do you think? And they will then make that decision about whether they need to have an expedited landing, in which case they would divert to a different airport, or if they can continue on that flight.
I appreciate that. Dr. Brady, there's been some controversy when folks identify themselves as medical help and the airline crew doesn't believe they're doctors or help. That's happened fairly notably in a few situations. Does the crew simply have to believe the person is a volunteer to help versus someone who just wants to help out but may not have the expertise?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And yes, there are situations where this does occur. What I would recommend to, frankly, any healthcare provider out there is, you know, first of all, carry some identification. I carry a copy of my work ID, which identifies me as an emergency physician. And if I'm asked, I can show that. And that's the most significant way I can document or prove that I am a doctor. I would recommend that for doctors, nurses, paramedics, healthcare providers that may be asked to step up and help out and then need to prove who in fact they are. The other issue, if you think about it from the airline's perspective, there is a medical kit on board, there is medical equipment on board, and the airline, you know, I understand where they're coming from. They need to be comfortable that they're giving this equipment that the airline owns to somebody that identifies him or herself as a healthcare provider. And they need to be comfortable with that. They need to be aware of it because they are responsible for the medical equipment they give to somebody. And unfortunately, in today's world, there are some people that misrepresent themselves and could cause more harm than good. So we have to be cautious and careful. And I think the other side of it too is to all the volunteer healthcare providers out there, thank you for doing what you do, but don't overstep your bounds. You know, if this is not something you do on a regular basis, if this is not something you're trained to do, if this is not something you're competent to perform, you shouldn't be doing it in an aircraft just like you won't be doing it on the ground.
Dr. Nabel, let me kind of follow up on a point that Dr. Brady just made about thanking the volunteers. Are there legal issues for the doctor or nurse or other healthcare team member that volunteers to help?
Great question. So in terms of legal issues, and a lot of healthcare providers, this is often a really important question for them. And for many, they often won't feel comfortable responding unless they know what their legal issues are surrounding this type of encounter. So thankfully, the federal government has provided some legal liability protection for responding providers, as long as they're acting, number one, in good faith, and number two, without gross negligence. So essentially, you know, a provider would have to be doing something that is totally shocking before the liability protection offered by the federal government is no longer valid. And it's, again, really fascinating how this liability protection initially came to be. It really was actually fairly recently, back in the late 90s. Prior to that, a lot of healthcare providers really felt deeply uncomfortable about rendering any sort of volunteer assistance because they had no idea what kind of liability they might face themselves. After all, you're flying in the skies over multiple states, and so you could be worried about getting sued in multiple states, the state of where that passenger is coming from, the state for which that airline is based out of. And thankfully, this has largely been addressed by the federal government in what's called the Aviation Medical Assistance Act.
Okay. And Dr. Brady, let's assume, okay, there's this in-flight emergency. You are over ocean. You're flying between LA and Tokyo, and it's just water. There's no place to land. What's done in that situation?
Well, the crew, and if there's an onboard volunteer provider, they need to do the best they can with the limited supplies and the very confined, limited environment to take care of the person. The pilot in command, in discussion with the volunteer provider and or if they have contact with the ground-based advising group that we've mentioned already, can make the decision to divert to the most appropriate landing area that has medical facility. But as you say, if you're halfway across the, you know, Northern Pacific Ocean, there's very few places to divert to. So that's a bad situation, and it does occur. You certainly can see this on the long haul flights from North America to Asia, certainly to Australia, New Zealand, really anytime you have a long overwater flight. And the answer is you do the best you can. And this really circles back to, let's be smart. Let's not get on an aircraft if we're not feeling well,
right. Because
you may be in a situation, if something untoward happens medically, where you're not going to have any help for maybe 2, 3, 4 hours. And that can be quite significant. So let's be smart and not travel when we shouldn't. And let's also be smart and talk to our primary healthcare provider so that we're prepared as best as possible to travel. And also, should we travel? So bottom line is, if you're over water and there's no place to land, then there's quite literally no place to land. And all the pilot can do, if it truly is a significant emergency, is divert to the closest landing field that has medical support.
Dr. Nabel, let's play the other side, and not to be on the dark end of this, but what if someone dies on the plane? How is that handled?
So if someone dies on the plane, that's an interesting question. And it actually has happened. And there, if you look at the literature, there are multiple news reports of this occurring. And there are a number of different issues that happen when someone dies on the plane. If you're over the ocean, you're not going to be landing anywhere. And so the aircraft or the airline crew needs to make accommodations for the decedent. And that can be challenging. There really isn't much room. If anyone has been on a commercial airliner recently, they are crammed. And so oftentimes there isn't much room. And so they're going to have to find a place for that body. And then the other issues associated with somebody dying on the plane is, you know, why did that person die, right? Like if somebody died because of an infectious issue, then you can bet that the authorities at the airport that you are landing at are going to have some questions. And so if somebody were to die on a plane, just as if somebody were to die on any other mode of transit, what's going to happen is likely you're going to, that aircraft is going to be met by local authorities, whether that's law enforcement or other healthcare professionals, to ensure that there isn't something else amiss associated with that death and something that needs to, in terms of concerns for the other passengers associated with that flight.
Isabella Da Silva, our director, joins us now with questions from our listeners for our experts. Mr. Postman. Isabella, what questions do we have today?
Hi, Dr. Servin.
Hi.
Donna from NYC. Where is the best place to sit to avoid getting an infectious disease on board like COVID or TB?
Dr. Brady, I think that the question being asked here, window or aisle when it comes to infectious diseases on a plane?
Well, not to be overly funny or trite here, but the best place to sit is on the ground, quite frankly. If you're traveling in an aircraft, you're in a pressurized cabin where the air is recirculating, and if there's an airborne pathogen that's contagious, highly contagious, like COVID,
right,
then there is certainly an increased chance of acquiring that infection. And I really don't think sitting in a window or an aisle would make a difference. Now, if we consider a even more recent infectious threat to us all, monkeypox,
right,
monkeypox is transmitted by large droplet. So it is in the air, but it's also a contact issue. So certainly sitting on the window area away from the aisle, particularly when people are getting on and off the aircraft, would prevent the contagious nature of contact infection. But frankly, aisle or window for COVID or some other airborne aerosolized pathogen, I really don't think it makes a difference where you sit on the aircraft.
Isabella, what else do we have?
Sam from Baltimore asks, is the water on board safe to drink?
Dr. Nabel, that's an interesting question from Sam, but I'll ask it.
Great question. So water on commercial airliners is certainly regulated by the government. So they are required to be potable. That being said, you know, aircraft are public and frequently used spaces, and it's really not entirely clear how often the dispensing stations or those receptacles are cleaned. So honestly, if you have any concerns, you can always just ask for the bottled water, right? Like that is almost always universally available. I certainly wouldn't be drinking the water from the lavatory, but if you have any concerns, I would go for the bottled water.
Isabella, what else do we have?
Lisa from Jacks Beach. Thoughts on passengers continuing to mask up in airports and flights to avoid other illnesses?
Dr. Brady, what advice do you have with regarding masking on planes now that you don't have to?
Yeah, you know, I think over the last 2 years, we've seen a significant reduction in flu cases, for example. That's primarily due to all of us masking up, or at least many of us masking up, and of course also the reduced human interaction. I think now that restrictions are being lifted, and in general, hopefully the world is returning to normal. We'll have to wait and see, but we're probably going to see more flu and more other respiratory based illnesses like the common cold, et cetera, et cetera. You know, I think it's reasonable if you're really concerned to wear a mask. And if you're going to wear a mask, wear an N95 mask or variant, because that truly is probably the best protection. Wearing some of these cloth masks, probably not as helpful. Maybe they're more comfortable, but I don't know if that is truly as helpful as wearing an N95 mask or variant. So I guess the bottom line is, if you're really worried about it, wear a mask and wear an appropriate mask. Talk to your primary healthcare provider about the best mask for you, which is the best way to prepare for your flight.
Very good. Isabella, what else do we have?
Jacinda from San Diego. Do people ever get sick from the airline food?
Dr. Nabel, I think this is obviously that there's a theme to these questions. I've always actually wondered that myself, but what comment? I guess are people worried about food poisoning in flight?
You know, that is, and you know, similar to the question regarding water, you know, You know, thankfully, illnesses associated with foods is quite rare in modern times. That being said, airline food is similar to food on the ground. You know, the safety of the food is predicated upon safe handling by everyone involved, right? So everyone who handles that food, you know, whether they're washing their hands and touching the food, you know, a lot of that will determine the safety of that food product. Just as food illness can happen in restaurants, they certainly can happen on aircraft as well. But thankfully, you know, this is fairly uncommon.
Isabella, another question, please.
Anonymous from Jacksonville. Does chewing gum at takeoff and landing really help prevent your ears from popping with pressure?
Dr. Brady, can you take that for us?
Yeah, so while not really an in-flight medical emergency, I think we've all experienced the popping sensation when you go from a lower altitude to a higher altitude. And yes, you know, swallowing a liquid, just swallowing your own saliva, chewing gum, that can certainly help you make sure that pressures both in and out of your ear are being equalized. Not equalizing the pressure produces that, you know, that sensation of popping, and in the rare case can cause significant pain. And in the very rare case, if someone has some sort of upper respiratory infection, can cause a rupture of your eardrum. But certainly chewing gum is a reasonable way of trying to keep that pressure equalized and reducing the chance of having the sensations or pain, or in the very rare situation, any kind of rupture of your eardrum.
I'm going to let that be our last word. I want to thank you, Dr. Brady, and you, Dr. Nabel, for really giving us this great advice. I hope that I get to fly with you guys, because it sounds like I want you on our flight so that we can always manage these things. But I want to thank you both for all your wisdom and advice today.
Well, our pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
Thank you so much.
It's been wonderful. We've been talking to Dr. William Brady. He is a professor of emergency medicine at the University of Virginia School of Medicine and an emergency medicine physician at the University of Virginia Health System in Charlottesville, Virginia. And Dr. Nabel, he is an emergency physician at MedStar Georgetown University Hospital and an associate professor of emergency medicine at the Georgetown University School of Medicine in Washington, D.C. Up next, we hear from a flight attendant on the front lines of in-flight health. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is What's Health Got to Do With It, and I'm Dr. Joe Servin. Today we're discussing in-flight health emergencies. Of all the professionals on the front lines of in-flight health issues, perhaps the most unsung ones are flight attendants. Ellen Church, a nurse from Iowa, approached Steve Stimson at Boeing Air Transport in 1930 with a novel idea of placing nurses aboard airliners. As such, flight attendants started out as flying nurses, which evolved into and glamorized flying hosts and hostesses in the 60s for commercial flights. Our next guest, Mark, has been a flight attendant since 1987. He joins us now to talk about his multi-decade experiences with in-flight health and has a few tales to tell. Mark, welcome to our show.
Thank you, Doctor.
It's a pleasure to have you here. So, Mark, let's start out with the most basic. Can you tell us a little bit about the health training you get as a flight attendant?
Well, in our initial training, we learn about basic first aid, how to spot problems on board, different symptoms to recognize, and then they teach us how to use the AED, which is the defibrillator that you may have seen with the paddles and all that. And
right.
We learn a CPR and the Heimlich maneuver and how to pre-flight all of our medical equipment that we have on board. So it's about a 6-week course altogether, but that includes the flying training as well and service and all the other aspects of being a flight attendant.
Does it? Do people feel pretty confident after they complete that training?
They do. Yeah, it's been said more than once that when the emergency happens, that your training just kind of kicks in automatically. We go through a recurrence every year where we have to kind of retrain on everything. That's 2 days per year. And we always stress about it because we have to pass a bunch of tests. But I guess that's good because, like I said, when it happens, you just kind of sometimes act somewhat automatically and do what you're supposed to do.
Mark, when someone has a health issue or emergency, what are the common ones that you've personally seen on board?
Lots of heart issues. Or what seemed to be at first heart issues. It's sometimes hard to tell. Lots of respiratory issues, people needing oxygen. We have overdoses. We have intoxication issues. People with dementia. Those are probably some of the most common. There's a lot of fainting that happens because people aren't used to the environment and the lack of oxygen. That's what I've seen for the most part.
Which kind of seems so similar to what we see on the ground that makes perfect sense to me.
Right.
How do flight attendants, let's say you're walking the aisles and you're at the beginning of the flight, how do flight attendants help to prevent problems before they occur as people are getting settled in or you're kind of just walking through the plane?
Well, because of my seniority, at this point in my career, after 35 years, I can pretty much hold whatever position I want on the plane. And we have different numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, and so forth. I always take number 2. And so I'm always in the back of the airplane. And I really like to be available to observe everybody that gets on during boarding. And I can spot potential problems before they happen. We also have a manifest. We carry a little tablet, and it has information about passengers that may have special needs, handicapped passengers, unaccompanied minors. And so we'll refer to that and kind of know what to expect before. And also people that carry their own oxygen supply, we need to know about that. And then also there's a whole list of equipment that needs to be pre-flighted, as I mentioned before. And so we make sure that all of our emergency and first aid equipment is up to snuff before anything could happen.
Got it. So over that 35-year career experience, what's the scariest in-flight health emergency that you've seen, and how did you guys manage it?
Well, it didn't go exactly according to routine, but I had a man that went into full cardiac arrest on the airplane. He was extremely obese, and what they tell us is to pull the person out of the chair and put them down on the ground so that you can start CPR, and this gentleman was just way too large to do this. So I started CPR, and then I ripped his shirt open to apply the defibrillator, and I noticed that he had a scar down his chest all the way from the top to the bottom.
Oh, wow.
And I went ahead and went through the whole process with the defibrillator and shocked him several times, and his pulse would just be kind of very thready for just a few seconds, and then it would just stop again. And he wasn't coming back. It's very unfortunate. And I was okay in the moment. Like I said, my training just kicked in. But then afterwards, they asked me if I wanted to get off of the trip, and I said no, I'll go on. And then I went into the bathroom, and I kind of broke down at that point because I realized, what I had just been through.
Oh my goodness! Wow.
Yeah.
Mark, on a kind of a variation on that question, instead of the scariest, what was the most unusual type of health emergency that you've had to manage?
Well, people would find it somewhat unusual, but it's happened to me more than once, and that is ladies that are getting prepared to get married. and they've dieted themselves so that they can fit into their wedding dress. And then on top of that, they have the stress of all of the planning for the wedding. And I've had more than one faint and fall into my lap while I'm sitting on the jump seat. So that's a little bit of a lighter note. But
wow. And more than once, just so I'm clear on that.
More than once, yes, yes. It's probably one of the most common things that's happened to me.
Wow. Okay. And that, it sounds so preventable, but okay. So that'll stay in my memory there.
Yeah. I said, I'll revive them and then I'll say, when did you eat last? And they'll say, oh, I don't know, maybe 2 days ago or something.
That may have something to do with the passing out.
Exactly. Yeah.
Mark, here you are, probably traveling the country, the world. I don't know what route you're assigned to, but how do you and your colleagues stay healthy while spending so much time at 30,000 plus feet? Are there any secrets that we passengers may benefit from that you're willing to share with us to stay healthy?
Well, number one is stay hydrated. Of course, we all know that for all situations, but especially on an airplane, the cabin is super dry. It's got that air circulating through the cabin over and over again, and it's a very dry environment. And then, as we said, of course, the altitude, the cabin altitude is, over 10,000 feet. So imagine yourself, being on a 10,000 foot mountain. There's a lot less oxygen up there. And then another thing is get plenty of rest before and after you travel. People have this misconception that flight attendants are out partying all the time when they're not working. But a lot of times our overnights are only, 10 to 12 hours. So basically, we need to just, get to our room and get to bed immediately. We call people that don't ever go out on their overnight slam clickers. That's when you slam the door to your hotel room and you click it shut. And there's a lot of people out there that do that. So make sure you get plenty of rest. And also, don't plan to do too much after flying. I found that if I work a red eye and I've been up the whole night, then I've got a whole list of errands that I'm trying to do the next day, it's just not going to work because I'm not capable of doing that. And then finally, I would say, make sure you give yourself plenty of time. Don't try to make a connection that's less than an hour between flights, because if anything goes wrong, then you're in trouble. And that's just adding to your stress level, which you don't need. And that, stress causes various medical issues as well. So those are the things I can think of just off the top of my head.
I love those secrets. That's very helpful. I am someone who will watch a good mystery or read one. And, I've caught HBO's The Flight Attendant and others. So shows like that have become really popular, but they may also add to lots of misconceptions. And you just mentioned that a moment ago. What's the biggest misconception about flight attendants from the flying public?
I would say that because it was funny, back in the 80s, there were a lot of movies and things that, and of course, they used to call them stewardesses back then, that really glamorized that kind of lifestyle. And don't get me wrong, we do have a lot of fun. And of course, we travel for free all over the world. That's great. But it's not always like that. That's one thing. And then also, I think people have a lot of misconceptions about what our job is. They tend to disrespect us sometimes because they think, oh, he just gave me a Coke, so that's what he does. He's a glorified waiter. But I think the more that they learn about our training and our experiences, I think it makes them respect us a lot more. And I think that's important to mention.
So important. Well, speaking of serving drinks, a lot of things seem to happen with alcohol in flight. Do you or can you stop someone from becoming drunk in flight? And why should we avoid alcohol anyway?
Definitely. First, once again, as I mentioned during the boarding process, we're all observing the passengers. We're saying hello, and that seems simple enough, but we're definitely observing their behavior. And, it's funny because people that have been drinking, they announce, that they're drunk when they first get on the airplane. So they make your life real easy as far as that's concerned. And then we sometimes the agents will try to board people that are somewhat intoxicated, and we'll put a stop to that right away because we don't really know what that person's going to do once we're locked up in that tube with them. You know, people have different reactions to alcohol. Some people, you know, get super nice and friendly and loving, and other people get violent. I had a friend that used to break down and start crying every time she'd start drinking. So you just have no idea. And then, of course, there's that lack of oxygen added to that. So I try not to board intoxicated people in the first place. I had a gentleman in Las Vegas that was obviously intoxicated when he got on the airplane. I gave him 3 warnings to tone it down because he was cursing and yelling and offending people with children and so forth. And then finally, I had the agent and the captain take him off the airplane, and he tried to square up and fight with me in the middle of the aisle. And by the way, we have security training and self-defense training, which a lot of people have made a big thing out of that since COVID, that we have self-defense training, but we've actually been doing it since 2001, since 9/11, doing this additional training. And then I even volunteered to do some training on top of that with the sheriff's office. That was an option that they gave us. But anyway, the gentleman backed down finally, and it's been great because passengers have been willing to back us up too. In that particular case, there was a guy that was crouched behind the intoxicated man, a very large man, super muscular looking guy, and he was ready to spring on that guy if anything should happen.
Wow.
And so we got the guy off, and I went up to the man to thank him, and I asked him what he did, and he said he was a rescue jumper for the Coast Guard. So he's one of those people that jumps out of helicopters into the ocean to save people. So I was I felt pretty confident that he could have taken care of the situation should anything happen.
That is absolutely amazing, but a reminder, you don't know who's on those planes with you, no matter what.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And since 9/11, like I said, people have been great to volunteer to help us if things go south, you know.
You know, I was just on a flight, international flight, just this past weekend. And one of the things I noticed is everyone with their heavy suitcases, and one of those came perilously close to my head. And I knew for sure I'd almost get a concussion. Have you seen concussions from just that initial act of placing those suitcases above in the overhead compartments?
Yeah, absolutely. Gentlemen had, I don't know if you're familiar with those, you know, those kind of... they almost look like they're stainless steel briefcases.
Yes.
They're super heavy duty. So there was one of those in the overhead. Older gentleman had put it up there, and then someone came along and decided to move it to put their bag behind it, which made it slide forward and hit the guy in the head. And he didn't have a concussion, I believe, but he had a pretty nasty cut on top of his head from that thing falling out and hitting him. So that's another thing that we're doing during boarding is we're observing the way the bags are put in there and helping people get them in there correctly so that incidents like that can't happen.
Let me ask you, we are still technically in the pandemic. COVID is still very much around, but planes got a lot of attention when people were beginning to fly with COVID. What was the COVID pandemic like from your perspective on planes, especially in those early days?
It was very odd. First of all, the planes were all empty for quite a while. I mean, you walk around the airport and you just see crew walking around. And so you're working on completely empty airplanes, maybe 2 or 3 passengers. And then when the passengers came back, you had a lot of people that had never flown before that were taking it as their first opportunity. And so you had a lot of inexperience, which can make your job a lot harder. And now it's somewhat back to normal, but maybe about 10% of the people on board are wearing masks. It's completely at their own discretion. And, you know, we don't shame anybody into wearing a mask or not wearing a mask. But we did have a lot of incidents when they were required to wear masks. That you know, of course, you've seen the stories on TV that led to violence and that sort of thing. So there was a whole period when you had a lot, like I said, a lot of those inexperienced people on board. And now the major difference is that we don't have the business travel so much anymore. You know, we, of course, we do have some people that are on business, but that was kind of the airline's bread and butter for a long time. And that's really changed a lot. I don't know whether it's for the good or for forever, but that's definitely a change. And like I said, it helps when people are experienced. Business travelers were experienced and they knew what to expect. So that made our lives a lot easier. But that's just kind of a few changes that have happened. And then I had to wear a mask, of course, all day long on the plane. And I might work a shift that went 14, 16 hours. And then I was wearing one to the airport. I was wearing a mask so much that I would get to my hotel room at the end of the day and still have my mask on and completely forget that I had it on. And I'd see myself in the mirror and say, oh, yeah, I could take this off now. But but yeah, it was a very odd time for sure.
Thanks so much for joining us and sharing these stories and advice with us. I know this is going to help a lot of folks out there.
Well, good. That's what we're here for.
We've been talking to Mark. He is a flight attendant with almost 30-plus years of experience since 1987. And he's been sharing with us best tips, stories regarding in-flight health issues. Well, that's our program for today. We hope you've enjoyed our show. We leave you today with Frank Sinatra's Ode to the Golden Age of Flying. If you missed anything, you can listen to the full episode at WJCT.org and on your favorite podcast app. Thanks to all of our guests. Our executive producer is David Luckin. Heather Schatz is our senior producer. Isabella Da Silva is our director. Next week's program will be our monthly medical roundtable. If you have questions for the panel or about any other subject, let us know by calling us at 904-358-6362. Emailing us at health@wjct.org or tweeting me at jservin. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and you're listening to What's Health Got to Do with It on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. Thank you for listening, and stay in touch.
It's such a cuckoo day. You just say those words, and we'll take our birds down to Acapulco Bay. It's so perfect for a flying honeymoon. Oh, babe, come fly with me. Let's fly, let's fly. Pack up, let's fly away. Pack a small bag.
Sponsored in part by Eli Lilly and Company. Is migraine impacting your life or daily activities 4 or more days per month? If so, ask your healthcare professional if you are a candidate for migraine prevention treatments and which ones might be best for you. Learn more at thinkmigraine.com. And the American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatment, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. And by the Epilepsy Foundation leads the fight to overcome the challenges of living with epilepsy and to accelerate therapies, stop seizures, find cures, and save lives. Visit epilepsy.com to find out how to get involved today.